Gilchrist versus Trail Canyon Industries, that Justice Zinner has disqualified itself, and that the court has appointed the Honorable Robert A. Miller, retired justice of this court, to sit in his place. Justice Miller is not able to attend the oral argument this morning, but there are tapes made of the oral argument, and he has read the briefs, and he will listen to the oral arguments when he returns. And yes, and the conference after, he's had an opportunity to do that, so you're in essence arguing with five justices this morning. With that, Mr. Johnson, who represents the appellant, Gilchrist, may proceed, and should note for the record also that Cheryl Woodmeyer Gearing represents the appellate. Mr. Johnson.
Once again, please, the court. This case has got a myriad of problems with it, and I think I'd like to start off stating that I think one of the principles that we have to keep in mind when I talk about this case is that the plaintiff should be entitled to feed upon spirit, unless it's a goofy theory. This was not a goofy theory, but normally the rule, and this court has said that a number of times, the plaintiff should be able to present their theory to the jury. This case, that didn't happen. In a nutshell, plaintiff's theory revolved around what happened to John Gilchrist following his injury in September of 94. December 13th of 1994, he was called down to the Trail King's office. At that time, he was taking therapy three times a week. He was having blood in his urine, feces. He was having severe shoulder pain and problems. He had ulcer problems. He had big varicose vein problems. And he was taking Darvocet. And they told him that they got a work release and he'd have to go back to work. And his testimony was, he said, I just can't do it. I'm not going to be able to go to work. As a matter of fact, I've got two doctor's appointments tomorrow, which he went to the next day, and both doctors said that he wasn't fit to go back to work. His theory was that they terminated him anyhow on that, and they, in fact, cut off his work comp benefits the following day. December 14th, they reduced him to $54 every 2 weeks because they said, you're supposed to be working. You should be working. Then a company immediately said, well, his local orthopod there said that he's got a rotator cuff injury, we're going to have an IME. They sent him over to Dr. Overstein. First, they sent him over on 12 hours notice, and he said, I can't make it that day. I'll have to make it a few days later, which he did. And that's one of the reasons they terminated his benefits. They said, you didn't go over and see Dr. Overstein like we told you to.
Are these all the facts that we had in Gilchrist 1 and 2?
There's a lot of them. Yeah. There's a lot of them that are in there.
And now this isn't the workers' comp.
No. This is
a bad faith claim.
This is bad faith revolving around this same kind of set of facts.
Yeah. Because he did get workers' comp benefits.
Right. Gilchrist 2, which unfortunately precedes Gilchrist 1 and the reporters, held that he was totally disabled. As the department held, Judge Zinner held that he was disabled, and this court affirmed it, that he was totally disabled, mentally disabled, and that further they held that
it caused his mental depression, is what we said in that case.
Yeah, right. It was one of those. There were two things that caused it, the injury, as well as the way the claim was handled. You said that in the case. That's what I get to.
I don't think we said the way. We said the evidence sustained, and the proof was there for it to find that there was a depression suffered by him from the job-related injury.
Yeah.
Wasn't that what we were saying?
Both that and the way the claim was handled is the language in Gilchrist. It's actually Gilchrist 2. What happened after that day, they sent him over to the IME. He goes over to see Dr. Overstein, and you don't have to be around this business very long to know that if there is a conservative IME doctor in the United States, Judge Overstein they'd have his picture there in the dictionary. Now,
they wouldn't call him judge, they'd call him doctor, I hope.
I mean doctor, yeah. All right, yeah. But at any rate, he goes over to see Dr. Overstein. He says, yeah, this guy's got a rotator cuff that needs surgery. Also, he's got carpal tunnel. Their own IME said that. they proceed to get the surgery set up, and then it's all in the other cases. John goes over there, and suddenly they call and say, well, we're not going to pay for the carpet.
They would do for all of it.
We'll pay for part of it, but not all of it. The doctor kind of denied it, but he says, how are you going to pay for the rest of this? And he's making $54 every 2 weeks, and he says, I don't know, you know. And that his depression state steadily went downhill, particularly after that surgery was denied. Now, I go to trial on this case. This case was handled. This work release that they used as a sledgehammer on him to start off with was they got from Dr. Choles. Now, she repudiated that. And it was got by a lady from Rehabilitation Strategies by the name of Kathleen Burns, who was a major player. I mean a major player from day one. She was the nurse that was supposed to be helping John get back to work. And they made a motion before the trial that since in Gilchrist, number one, Rehabilitation Strategies was granted summary judgment in this claim, that we can't mention her name during the trial. Now, talk about a laborious deal. Her name was in virtually every document. We had to stop every document. We have to redact her name or anything that she did with pencils. I could not mention this lady's name in the case, and they did it. They said, well, since she's not liable, we can't even mention her in connection with what Trail King did. And it forced me to try this case in a vacuum. And actually, it got to the point where I wasn't even able to read Dr. Cho's deposition, who explained the circumstances. She said, I gave that work permit because the only reason I gave it is because Kathleen didn't tell me the facts. She said, I didn't know he had these other problems. I didn't know he had these other doctors. I didn't know that he had this carpal tunnel from the time of the accident. So she repudiated. I was not even permitted to read her deposition because she mentions Kathleen Burns in the deposition.
In the first one, we said that there was not an adequate showing, or you couldn't show any responsibility for a bad faith claim against Burns and her employer, could you?
Well, the first quiet case said was that unless I could show that Burns' employer was responsible for additional injuries, why then we could not bring a bad faith claim against her.
There was no bad faith claim allowed against her.
That's right, because there was no proof there that there were additional injuries caused by her. But that does not have anything to do with the injuries that were clearly related to what happened by Trail King. In this case, and Judge, even if they could have said, well, they're not liable for some reason, you can't just strike her name from everything and leave the jury trying to figure out, well, who's doing this? Is there a ghost out there that's responsible for all this? I made an offer of proof at one point there where I think there's 27 different exhibits. All of them are basically correspondence about what she did. At least half of them are communications between her and Trail King about what we're going to try to come up with a reason so they could discontinue John's benefits. And but the truth of the matter is, after Dr. Hoverston, he came up with an opinion and said, yeah, you need this stuff. Then he developed a psychiatrist, Dr. Stanley, and they sent him to an IME to Dr. Bean there, and Dr. Bean agrees with Dr. Stanley. He is disabled. He is depressed from all of this. And then Dr. Cho repudiates the work release.
Did you not get in what Dr. Bean said?
No, they wouldn't let me put that in. The IME report, I thought, was something that would show evidence on their part. I was not permitted to put that in. So, and I couldn't nor read my own doctor's deposition, Dr. Cho, as to what happened on that work release. So, like I said, I thought it was like trying a case in a vacuum. I wanted to, and one of the things that really galled me, which I thought tells the story of this, the way this man was treated better than anything, is sending to Hoverston, who orders an IME, or who orders an MRI over He can. He goes over and gets him, it costs $1,000 for an MRI. And they won't pay that. He gets the bill. He's stuck for that. And they said, well, the MRI didn't help or something. I don't know. But here's their own IME doctor has him go get an MRI. And Trail King refuses to pay it. Now, that was the attitude generally that they took toward this man's claim.
But that did get it.
What?
That did get it. That time. But they wanted him to pay the MRI. That got him before the jury.
I think that one might have got in, although I was prohibited from mentioning anything that happened after February 22nd of 1995, which is the day that the surgery was canceled for all practical purposes. As this case goes on...
But I thought when I looked at this that you're pleading the ledge that everything that happened, it happened before that time.
Well, that's right, but...
Was there an amendment to pleadings as far as to show that there was conduct after that date?
Well...
Did you move to amend to say, I want to bring in all this other stuff that happened after fortify?
I didn't move to amend it, but I think that the evidence afterwards confirms the inferences that could relate to what happened up until February 22nd.
But, I mean, when the judge didn't let you put it in, what was his rationale? Because it wasn't within the time frame of when this conduct occurred, or what?
Well, they said that's when they first denied any coverage issues, and therefore there's nothing going to come in after that. That's under that decision that says that the decision needs to be made as of the date that, or the evidence needs to be considered as of that date. But that doesn't mean that that's the only evidence that can relate. That was my contention. I was really disturbed, Your Honor, this went to the jury. The Isaac case you decided, this court approved a bad faith instruction. Set forth right in the decision, right in the sentence. They took this instruction and took the middle paragraph out of it, which says that knowledge of, that they have to make a fair investigation before they can deny a claim, and that the knowledge can be inferred from the circumstances or their conduct or their actions, surreptitious activities, etc. There's a paragraph that was taken out of this instruction that was approved by this court, and I thought it was significant throughout these proceedings.
Did you offer the entire instructions?
You bet. You bet. Word for word, right out of high school. I want to move on, if I could, to point number two. As you pointed out, Justice Anderson, this ground has been plowed. Already been plowed a couple of times, but basically his work comp claim was plowed in Gilchrist too. And it went up, first of all, when this case was started, and this was before Zook was decided, they put this case on hold pending the outcome of the administrative proceeding. We want to see what they say, and that's what you said we should do. Well, they did that, went and ended up bouncing around. It went finally to the Department of Labor, and the Judge Center, and to this court. There were a lot of findings in the below that I thought we shouldn't have to retry. And we asked, I'm suggesting that under 1910.4, that it's mandatory if we give it to them for them to take judicial notice of what's been already determined by this court and the Department of Labor and Judge Zinner, or affirmed by this court from the Department of Labor and Judge Zinner.
But well, none of that was... been able to get in the fact that, you know, if you got bad faith, there's got to be bad faith for a reason. And you're saying that they denied a legitimate workers' comp claim, is what you're saying was a bad faith.
That's one of the things they did.
Yeah, okay. Well, you must have been able to get in that he prevailed on his workers' comp claim. He got the entitlement to it. Did
well,
that go in front of the jury?
They put that, the defendants got that in an instruction, but I was not able to put in what else they found in support of it. The defendants got an instruction stating they can't even award lost earnings or wages here in this case because the workers' comp was paid. And they also got in an instruction stating it was proper for him to discharge him because he was gone from work. There was a lot of, I thought, were very unfair instructions. They're just, they were dictated the night before. A lot of them, they're not taken from any case. They're not taken from any pattern instructions. A lot of them are speaking instructions about the evidence. And they were submitted to this jury that that I think, I raised all of this, it's in the motion for new trial for the circuit judge, I tried to bring it to his attention, and I made my most offers of proof, I made my objections during the trial.
Are you saying then that the trial court gave instructions to the jury that have no authority?
That's right.
That they can be based on?
That's right.
Which ones are they?
Well, let's take a look at instruction number 17, for example, where they held that it was proper for Trail King to fire him in this case. They made an observation in there because he hadn't been at work. Instruction number 23 says that there can be no bad faith if a company acts on a mistaken belief. Well, now here we are, a mistaken belief. They said if they have a mistaken belief, you cannot recover them for bad faith. Now, that ignores the law on bad faith, which they have to conduct a full and fair investigation to arrive at whether it's to arrive at a fair belief. In this case, all of the doctors, including their IME doctors, supported.
There was no instruction as far as on their duty to investigate.
There's no instruction on the duty to investigate, and the part of the inferences of the Isaac case was left out. There's an instruction number 36 where they said Kathy Burns did nothing wrong. She didn't do anything wrong. And in a vacuum, but she was working with them as on plaintiff's theory.
Well, now, let me ask you this. You said there's an instruction that specifically mentions Kathy Burns?
Oh, yeah. It's kind of a funny instruction, Your Honor, because the court says, you haven't heard much about Kathy Burns during this trial. But, and it goes on to say, however, I want you to know that she didn't do anything wrong. Now that's what the instruction says. Now there's no authority for that, Judge. That thing was dreamed up by defense counsel the night before.
And this is after all your evidence on her got redacted.
Yeah, right.
Why was there any question if it's redacted on her that she her name would even be in there?
It came up once that I can remember during the trial after we tried and tried and tried. Came in one time during the trial, her name was mentioned.
Going back for a minute, I wanted to make sure I'm clear on this. Did you say that the Dr. Cho deposition could not even be read because Kathy Burns' name appeared in that deposition?
Right.
Why wasn't it just redacted out of there?
Well, I did offer parts of it, but the key was, see, Dr. Cho had was burned. Kathy had been over to her place, worked on her, said, well, I gotta have we have a nice easy job, you can do it, got her to sign. She was the one that induced her to sign the work release. So Cho gives a deposition, stated, I was misled about this. I would not have signed it if I'd known the truth. And, but it all involves that Kathy Burns was the one that was misleading her to sign it. And so it was almost impossible to redact her name. What are you gonna say? Blank came over and did that, you know. But at any rate, the judge, then I offered to read parts of the deposition. I offered to read the 5 or 6 pages of the deposition, and that was also refused. Judge, another one, I have to mention another one. Take a look, if you would, at instruction 38 and see if you can find authority for that. They said, well, he can't recover for any lost earnings or earning capacity because he's being paid by workers' comp. I mean, what I tell the judge, I said, Judge, workers' comp only pays 2/3. Furthermore, he had a little farm and ranching operation that we said that was affected by this. But if they could find an authority for that instruction, I'd like to, you know, they should do so. They should tell the court about it.
Well, the question I have, if you got odd lot, that says the individual can't work. So how can you lose any earning capacity if you can't work?
Well, earning capacity, he's disabled. But when you talk about lost income and lost earnings, you're still only paid 2/3 of what you get. Workers' comp doesn't cover 100%
of
what
you're lost. Give and take on the workers' comp as far as the person no fault deal,
right.
I thought.
That all related to the wrongful termination claim.
Okay.
Yeah. So, in this case, you can look through those instructions as to what their duty is. Oh, you know, I know you're going to hear it, it says this. They have a right to deny claims that are fairly debatable. Fine. But if you don't look, if you don't know anything, if you don't want to know anything, and if you're intentionally trying to warp the facts, to say, well, it's debatable, that isn't a proper argument. They submitted that, they argued that to the jury. And you can't find anywhere where they said, unless we could prove that they knew that this wasn't debatable or whatever, we had to prove that they knew and we couldn't use any inferences at all in this trial. Unless I could prove that they knew, this man, the plaintiff's case was dead. And that wasn't fair.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. I guess I didn't ask. Gary, the case. Ms. Gary, are you going to be doing all the arguing?
Yes.
Okay, then you may proceed. Thank you. Ms. Moynihan.
Thank you. May it please the court. On behalf of Trail King Industries, I respectfully assert that trial judge Ronald Miller did not commit error in this case when he made the evidentiary rulings that he made and when he gave the jury instructions which he gave. The plaintiff or the appellant in this case has not sustained their burden. They cannot show that he abused his discretion in the evidentiary rulings. They have not shown that his rulings were beyond clear reason in the evidence. And also they have not sustained their burden in showing that the jury instructions that were given were against competent evidence and a misstatement of the law, or that the instructions that they submitted were the proper statements of the law. Furthermore, they haven't shown prejudice. And those are the things I'm going to talk about briefly here this morning in regard to the assertions that they've made.
Well, let me ask you this, and we always like something that comes a lot fresh in my mind. I'm getting old, I don't even remember. But there's no question that this name of this individual was redacted. Is it?
That's true, because in light of this court's ruling in Gilchrist 1, that the actions of Kathleen Burns and rehabilitation strategies were not actionable, the trial court held that...
Actionable, but he said because of the fact they didn't show any additional injury. But okay, so we've got that. But if you can't mention the individual, you can't even bring it up. Why is there an instruction that says, jury, oh, by the way, we can't talk about X, but just for your information, X did nothing wrong. That seems inconsistent.
No, it isn't, because at pages 554 through 556 of that transcript, they read into evidence Dr. Cho's affidavit that she had given in below, in which she specifically says, I was misled by Kathy Burns. She didn't provide me with all the evidence that I needed. When I gave her that work release, because I didn't have it and because of Ms. Burns' actions, I hereby repudiate what I said.
Why wasn't that redacted if everything else was?
Because that was only her action. How could it be redacted? Trail King didn't have anything to do with it. Dr. Cho never said that anybody at Trail King did anything. The only person she ever communicated with in regard to that work release was Kathy Burns. If it's going to come in, it has to mention Kathy Burns because she's the only one who did the action. And so that, and it was stressed in closing. If you read the closing transcript at pages 9 through 10 and 13, plaintiff's counsel is standing in front of that jury saying, you heard the affidavit of Dr. Cho. She repudiated. They emphasize that Dr. Cho, based on the actions of Kathy Burns, repudiated her testimony, repudiated that work slip.
But and for the trial court judge to say that Kathy Burns did no wrong, isn't that just clearly an improper comment on the evidence on his part?
No, I don't believe it is, and I don't believe that's the specific language of what he said. He just said that in another proceeding, and this is instruction 36, in another proceeding, the case manager, it was determined that the case manager did not act in bad faith and did not engage in extreme or outrageous conduct. He didn't say that she didn't do anything wrong, he just said that it was determined that she did not act in bad faith and did not engage in extreme or outrageous conduct.
And that's what was said in Gilchrist 1, is what you're saying?
Yes, that was the holding in Gilchrist 1.
As it dealt with Burns and rehabilitation.
Right, and it's our assertion that because she was the agent of Trail King, that under principles of principal and agent, this court's decision in the state of Williams, which is a 2000 case, and most recently in the Kraus case, which was a decision just issued in June of this past year, that if the agent is released, then the principal is also released. And we've cited other cases at page 15 of our brief from other jurisdictions that extended beyond the situation of a written settlement agreement, that if the agent cannot be held liable, you can't hold the principal liable for the agent's actions. And that's what the appellant was trying to do. They were trying to hold Trail King liable for the actions of Kathy Burns. In fact, they even proposed an instruction that said that ultimately it wasn't given.
But the Williams case didn't have a bad faith aspect to it. That was a whether or not they could collect from, I think, the brothers after they settled with, like, the actual tort season.
Well, that's correct. It was a written settlement agreement of the parties, but we would assert, and we've cited the Schieffer case and the Hatcher case and other cases from other courts in which they have said, due to immunity or some other legal reasoning of the court, the agent was not liable. They have said, as a matter of black letter law, that you can't then hold the principal liable for those same actions. It's just inconsistent.
Well, but the reason in the Gilchrist one why Kathy Burns was found not liable, or her employer was special, like to the effect that that they couldn't be held for bad faith, right? I mean, bad faith is only a question against the principal, not against the agent. So still, I don't understand why the principal is not bound by the acts of the agent, or at least it becomes proper evidence to determine what the acts of the principal should be.
If, as I read Gilchrist 1, and I think as the trial court, who also had that information available to him, and read the opinion, the question was whether Kathy Burns and Rehab Strategies owed a duty to Mr. Gilchrist. That was the question that the court was faced with. Did they owe a duty?
They did.
Right. If they didn't owe a duty, then how could their actions be wrongful? Because, again, they're not saying, and this is where it gets into whether I don't believe the appellant has made a proper offer of proof or preserved their record. If the appellant had shown that Norm Tarbell, who worked for Trail King, or Sharon Kreider, who worked for Risk Administration, that they had some role in what Kathleen Burns was doing, that they were directing her, they were working with her in talking with her and saying, you need to do this, Kathy. There's absolutely no evidence of that, and the trial court specifically told appellant's counsel, when he was making these rulings outside the presence of the jury, he said, you can still ask Mr. Tarbell these questions. That's at page 172 of the transcript. At page 440 of the transcript, the trial judge said, appellant, you can still ask Sharon Kreider the following questions. What did she direct to be done? In fact, appellant had even subpoenaed Kathleen Burns and never brought her in to make an offer of proof, and at pages 163 and 164 of the trial transcript, the trial court said, bring Kathleen Burns in here, and if she's going to testify that Trail King told her to do these things, directed her to do these things, was involved in making these decisions, I could revisit. But the appellant never did that. And so we would assert that the appellant has not preserved their record and has not made sufficient showing in this case to bring this issue before the court. The same holds true as the events after February 22 of 1995. They did not amend their complaint. The advice of counsel is a defense, or a factor at least, that Trail King would have been able to assert. And counsel for Trail King would have been a witness at that point in time. But because the complaint had never been amended, there was no reason for Trail King to believe that those events were going to come up, that they would need to rely on advice of counsel. And so, it was for those reasons and the fact that in the Juulsen case, this court said, you look at the time of denial that the trial court held that he wasn't going to allow any evidence of claimed bad faith after February 22nd, 1995.
But that misses the point as to relevant evidence. Let's assume a person of Trail King after February 28th, okay, made an admission that they were wrong and they were clearly in bad faith when they denied the claim. Do you feel that that evidence would be improper just because of the reason that it came 6 days after the date?
If there would be such evidence, we could argue about it. There is no such evidence.
There is. I know that. I'm giving you a hypothetical. I'm saying if there was, it's admissible evidence, even if the pleadings only go up to February 27th, because it proves what happened before February 27th.
I think that could be true in the context if the plaintiff or the appellant in this case would have brought it up before, so that Trail King could have then made its own decision at that time. We want to rely on advice of counsel, so we're going to have to get different counsel to try this case because the counsel that have been assisting us in the workers' compensation proceeding are also our trial counsel. But because of the nature of the pleadings, Trail King didn't give that up, wasn't given that opportunity. So while it could be relevant in that hypothetical situation, I believe in this context the trial court did not abuse its discretion because of the way the case was presented. In addition, we would assert that numerous matters which the appellant now says I wasn't allowed to bring up, they very much were allowed to bring up. Issues of causation. They wanted a jury instruction on judicial notice taken of causation. In the trial transcript of the wife's testimony at pages 69 through 106, the claimant's testimony at 175 to 231, the daughter's testimony at pages 119 through 135, they all speak to causation of what caused Mr. Gilchrist's problems. Dr. Hoverston, his deposition was read to the jury. In there, he talked about the two surgeries and the reasons given. Even Rob Anderson, who was the expert witness called on behalf of the defense on the issue of bad faith, appellant cross-examining him and said, didn't the Supreme Court of South Dakota rule that Mr. Gilchrist was proper in refusing to do just one surgery? And Rob said yes, at the page 598 of the transcript. The physical or mental problems before that he didn't have that, that's in the trial transcript at pages 74 through 76, and they put it in exhibit 61 that talked about that. The fact that right carpal tunnel was later found to be work-related. The transcript at the jury instruction specifically said that, and it's referenced at page 355. Dr. Christensen and Dr. Leland saying that they had that they would not return him to work. Exhibits 57 and 58 came into evidence. The letters regarding return to work is exhibit 20. That came into evidence. Talking about what happened with his depression, Dr. Stanley, his deposition was read to the jury and talked about not only the injury, but the actions of Trail King and how they contributed allegedly to his mental depression. All of these things and others that we pointed out in our brief, we believe were presented to the jury, and that the court properly determined that judicial notice need not be taken of the additional matters that the appellant was asserting because they were already in evidence and could be argued. In effect, we assert that what the appellant was doing, because they did not have an expert witness on the issue of bad faith, they were trying to get matters before the jury in that fashion so that they could make arguments in closing rather than calling their own expert witness to say what Mr. Anderson had said beginning at page 567 of the transcript, that there is no bad faith here, that it was handled appropriately. Similarly, we assert that the jury instructions were properly given. Let me just talk about the jury instructions raised today by appellant's counsel. Instruction 17. Instruction 17 stated that when an individual is not able to work, you can terminate them. That's based on South Dakota codified law 60-4-5 and the Weinzelt decision of this court, in which it said simply because someone is absent because of a work-related injury does not violate public policy. So that instruction was clearly based on the law. Instruction number 23, mistaken belief that just because a Trail King may be mistaken, it is not necessarily liable for bad faith. That's based on the Case versus Toshiba decision, which is a federal South Dakota Supreme Court case, federal district court case cited in the briefs, which specifically talks about that. Instruction 38, which is the damages instruction. There were numerous cases cited to the court, but specifically on the issue of economic damages available in bad faith. Gilchrist 1 supports that decision, but so does Pishon, which is a California 1989 decision cited in our brief, and the Alexander case, a Pennsylvania decision from 1986, both of which held if a person is getting workers' compensation benefits, they don't have any additional harm related to their lost wage claim. The instruction did allow the appellant to argue that if you have economic loss above what's not been compensated, not for lost wages or for medical expenses, but if he did show to the jury something related to his cattle, we assert that the instruction still would have allowed the jury to award those types of damages, but it's just, it doesn't make any sense based on the Pishon and Alexander cases. And
was there a project. Ralph Brown that testified as to damages?
No.
Okay.
The plaintiff himself argued as to damages, and obviously called his wife and his daughter and other, a friend of the family to talk about how it affected him. He talked about a judgment being entered against him related to the MRI that was mentioned by a appellant's counsel. Sharon Kreider for Risk Administration, who requested Dr. Hoverston review it, who made the decision not to pay the MRI, stated she was not aware of South Dakota law of work comp requiring her to pay it. Appellant's counsel tried to introduce a jury instruction based on the Mettler decision from this court in 2001. But a decision in 2001 saying what the law is then is not what the law was in 1994 and 1995 when Ms. Kreider was making a decision. We would assert that plaintiff is trying to get a second bite at the apple. They presented their evidence to the jury, argued why there was bad faith on the part of Trail King, why Trail King wrongfully terminated Mr. Gilchrist. They argued that he intentionally inflicted emotional distress on Mr. Gilchrist. And in a special verdict form, the jury said, we find for the defendant on each of those liability claims. They presented all of this evidence. The fact that they didn't get into evidence, actions that weren't even Trail King's. They were actions of Kathleen Burns, we would assert is not reason to reverse the trial court in this case. We believe that many of the jury instructions, as with some of the offers of proof, that they have not preserved their error, that they did not properly raise to the trial court the issues which they're now raising to this court, and because they did not give the trial court the opportunity to review those issues. This court should not take that up for the first time. The issue specifically regarding Isaac, they now complain about whether there is language in Isaac in the jury instruction in that case that was not included in one of the court's instructions. From reading the trial transcript, I don't believe that they argued that at all to the trial court. They had other issues regarding that jury instruction, but they didn't bring up the fact that there was some missing language.
Did they propose the entire instruction?
I don't recall that they did.
No. You just stated that they did on those occasions.
I haven't looked at their proposed instructions recently to be able to state definitively, but I don't recall them, what they proposed, but I know specifically when they did, as I looked at the trial transcript and it relates to the instruction that was given, they did not object on that basis.
Well, tell me, what counsel is saying is that they took or they wanted what this court said the law was in Isaac, put into the instructions. But you got the court to delete a paragraph, is what he basically said here, right?
Right.
Okay. Why was the paragraph deleted?
Well, again, because it wasn't discussed in the trial court, I don't know that I can say what the court's reasoning is, but if I recall correctly, when we were debating what the instructions should read, the trial court was saying, what was the evidence? What evidence are you asking?
To support the giving of that, and there has to be this structure, basically, or the support, therefore, to come out of, you say, that wasn't in the record, as the trial court said.
Well, I believe that was part of the discussion, again, because it's disjunctive and that they didn't bring it up at the time of this instruction. I believe it was associated with other instructions that they were making that type of argument, so I don't know that we can even infer it for the specific one, but they did make those arguments in relation to it to others, and the trial court would say...
So the evidence did support part of the Isaac, but you're saying it doesn't support the other part that was deleted.
Right.
Is that what the record would reflect when reviewing?
I believe so. And I also believe...
Your time has expired.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Your Honor, maybe if I could, I'd like to refer to, like, starting at page 11 of the appellee's brief in this case. And you'll note that they state there on page 11 through page 12 through page 13, these are all the exhibits. You can see I had them pre-marked. I start with exhibit 8, and it runs up through almost consecutive up through exhibit 40, then it jumps in all the way up to exhibit 70. Now these are all the exhibits of the circumstances of what happened in this case. They were all denied. Every one of those exhibits was denied. I was not allowed to present any of them because they relate to Kathleen Burns.
All 70 of them?
Well, no, there's 28, starting on page 11 through page, they're all cited there. There's about 28 of them, I think.
All right.
28 that were numbered starting pretty much 8, 9, 10, 11. I see 8 through 16 or so. 8 through 16, for example. Early, my important exhibits, they were all denied. Well, she says, well, Kathleen Burns was subpoenaed. You're darn right. She was subpoenaed. She was sitting out in the hall. I was waiting to call her, but I was not permitted to do so. The court granted a motion in limine stating I couldn't mention her name. Secondly, he refused all my, I made my offer of proof on all these exhibits that referred to her. I was not permitted to either call her or to offer the exhibits that related
to her. Hold it. I thought counsel said that the court told you that if you want to put out an offer of proof, I'll reconsider it. Is that inaccurate?
Oh, no, that's wrong. My offer of proof runs for like 5 pages on this. With all of these, I went through every one of these exhibits.
But I thought she said that later in the trial, as the trial progressed.
No.
That isn't in there?
No. Once it was denied, it was denied, and it stayed denied. And as a matter of fact, Judge Miller said a couple of things. He said, you know, I'm not exactly sure what I got into when I denied it, but I'm not going to change. I'm not going to change in the middle of the stream. He stayed right to his horses right through the end.
So when you say Judge Miller said that to you, I assume you said it on the record.
I think it's in the record,
okay.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I want to think. I want to know it is.
I can't
sit here and guess what you and Miller talked about.
I just think that he said it sometime, a couple of times, when I made motions. He says, I ruled that way before, and I'm not changing my ruling now, basically.
Okay.
So, now, they talk about that I offer instructions. Now, I didn't put the exact pages of where that's at. I know that they were proposed, and furthermore, there was a lengthy objection to what the court gave in that regard. I thought, let's just take a look, for example, on page 31 of my brief, we have that Kathy Burns instruction. And actually, my objection to that is set forth, or maybe Mr. Grossenberg's, I think it's mine. They point out that they hired her in November of 94. Well, there was no evidence of that. We weren't able to talk about her. Then they go on. It's just a narrative statement about facts that were never presented to this jury. They were...
You say that your use of Captain Burns' trial was extremely limited. Did this also apply to pretrial discovery?
No.
So you were able... You knew before trial what you wanted to get?
I had all these exhibits pre-marked before we went there, and we deposed Dr. Cho, of course.
Did you depose Kathleen Burns before trial?
You bet. I deposed her. I had her deposition, including all of these exhibits.
And then when you wanted to put that in, did you offer that as a part of the offer, what she said in the deposition or anything like that?
I think I may have made reference to it, but I certainly offered all those exhibits, 28 of exhibits, that all showed discourse between Trail King and her.
And that deposition is part of the record and was relied on by the trial court of her?
Well, I think it's in the record. I can't recall that, but I believe so because it was on the appeal, the prior appeal. It was made a part of that record, and I'm sure that's in the record. When he granted summary judgment before, we had that already. But see, look at that on page 32. He said, it has been determined in another case that the nurse, in another proceeding, that the nurse case manager did not act in bad faith and did not engage in extreme or outrageous conduct. Accordingly, you are instructed that defendant Trail King Industries cannot be held liable for any of the actions of Rehabilitation Strategies, Inc. or Kathy Burns. I mean, she's their agent. If she's not their agent, she's an independent contractor that they had to monitor. But it's clear from those exhibits that she was hired to be their man on the scene.
Page 32 of your brief, you say the record shows that Burns was in almost daily telephone contact with Tarbell,
right,
the loss control manager of Trail King.
Right.
Doing everything she did was with his advice and consent. And yet, what you're really saying is you were never able to show what Trail King knew or when they knew it.
I couldn't show that because, what I could show was her reports to Tarbell. That's exhibits, all exhibits that were reviewed. It would show where they knew, like she says, she'd like to get her.
None of those reports went in?
None of them. I couldn't get any of those reports.
Was this motion limited right at the time of trial or previous?
Just before the start of the trial.
So you really had to overhaul your whole case on the spot?
I was dumbfounded. But I did offer, I did prepare a very extensive offer of proof with all my exhibits so that this court could take a look at it later. I have one other thing I wanted to mention.
So you say if we look at your offer of proof, that will obviously show what the prejudice was in this case by the denial of that.
Well, it will certainly show what my theory was in this case that I should have been able to explore and present in this case. That she was acting as their agent on the street dealing with the doctors and things. And they just couldn't disavow her. I think that if they can't disavow knowledge of what she did or being responsible for what she did.
But they can also rely on this court's holding in Gilchrist 1 that we didn't find she did anything wrong.
Well, they didn't say that exactly on the bad faith. They said that they can't hold her responsible because of her position unless she did some additional damage. They didn't talk about the original damage, just whether she, she's the messenger, Judge. You can't kill a messenger on the deal. I think that's... when they say that she said that she didn't have any role in it, that really troubles me because if you want to take the time to look at those exhibits I marked, she had a role in this thing, she'd like to get John away from Dr. Cho because she didn't like the way Dr. Cho was doing things. And then she says, I've got my fingers crossed, I've sent Cho these things, I'm trying to get her to give a work release, Then it turns out that she just given Dr. Cho part of the information. This thing he didn't get that surgery until after the department ruled that he was entitled to it in 1998. He didn't get any benefits until this court ruled in 2000. But we went 4 years without him even having surgery in this case. And it's because because all goes back to whether he was entitled to it back there where we are, and he's worked countlessly. I just didn't get a fair chance to present this man's claim.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. Court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock.